and welcome to The Celtic Way, a mini podcast series where we talk to fans who've been involved in successful campaigns around Celtic. Through the series, we'll talk to three individuals about their fight for change, what made their campaign successful, and what lessons can be taken from their work in light of the current situation. In this series, as well as finding out about the people and the organisations, we hope that we can start to find ways and develop ideas about how change can happen at Celtic going forward. In this episode, Claire Wilde talks to Paul Quigley of Fans Against Criminalisation about what they've achieved, how they've managed their own campaign, and what lessons have been learned.
Hello and welcome. I'm Claire Wilde and I am here today with Paul Quigley from the FAC campaign. Now, hi Paul, how are you?
Hi Claire, I'm great, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well. Quickly explain to us what FAC stands for and what the FAC campaign is before we get into the meat of having a chat.
Yeah, of course. So FAC stands for Fans Against Criminalisation. We were set up as a campaigning group, I guess, a single issue group back in 2011, founded by, at the time, the kind of five main Celtic fan organisations to oppose the Offensive Behaviour at Football Act. But we sort of became a broader movement that was inclusive of all fans as things change, as we kind of moved on. And we kind of campaigned initially to try and prevent the act coming in, but then campaigned to have it repealed.
Yeah. And how did you, I mean, what's your sort of personal story in terms of like being a Celtic fan and then getting into this when obviously the law was going through the parliament?
So FAC would have been formed in, I think it would have been the summer of 2011. Mm-hmm. So the Offensive Behaviour Act came about sort of partially at least as a result of the kind of shame game that happened in, I think, February, March of that year. We'll maybe get into that a bit later. Yeah. But what then happens is once the kind of legislation had been drafted by the Scottish Government, they attempted to bring it in just before the summer recess. Mm-hmm. Before Scotland went to vote, there was Scottish elections that May. But it was eventually shelved because of some disastrous performances from some Scottish ministers at the Scottish Parliament. So what happened then was the Celtic support, I think, as a whole, rather than just individual groups, was really kind of clicking on to the dangers of this piece of legislation, specifically how it appeared to be targeted towards our support. So what began happening was, I think the first meeting was called, I think it might have even been at Celtic Park, of the sort of five main organisations, which I didn't attend. So I didn't really get involved until maybe 4 or 5 months later. Actually, it was one of our members who was driving things at the time, but he couldn't make a meeting. So I was to be a representative one night. And it just sort of so happened that, I don't know, the kind of stars aligned a little bit. I ended up getting a little bit more involved. And then further down the line, I guess, became, you know, one of the kind of faces and spokespersons for the campaign.
Great. And you mentioned there about bringing other groups in, and obviously it started. Obviously, I guess there's two levels of that. There's the bringing the different factions of the Celtic support together, first of all, and then even widening that out further. And I wondered, obviously, there's, in current circumstances, it's easy to see that, you know, even when we kind of want the same thing, sometimes it can be difficult to bring ourselves together to know what the best thing to do is. And I just wondered whether you and, you know, your colleagues on the campaign, sort of, how did you figure that out and how did that come about?
Well, I mean, you're right in terms of there are many different kind of facets and aspects of our support, a lot of people with different views. But I think that we were united in a kind of common goal at that point. Now, that doesn't mean that over the course of the 7-8 years where the campaign was most active that we all agreed on everything, because, of course, that wasn't possible. But the various groups were able to come together in a meaningful way to make sure that there was always a kind of constant opposition to the legislation. And after maybe the first year or two, that really began to expand out. And it expanded in terms of are bringing in different, you know, supporters groups and fans from other clubs. Motherwell, Hamilton, a few others were really active in the campaign. But also in terms of engaging with people politically, that, you know, if I, you know, had a choice, I wouldn't have necessarily been sitting down with Douglas Ross to discuss the legislation. But at the same time, you know, in terms of trying to pursue a single issue campaign, unity really was the only option in trying to bring people together. And if it meant that, you know, we had to disagree on some things but agree on others, then that's what we've done.
So I guess that's about just having that very kind of clear focal point for everyone to kind of rally around.
I think we had a clear message from the start. And I think that the way that the campaign started was, you know, that we were quite openly saying that we felt that this piece of legislation was specifically targeted and designed to target Celtic fans. Mm-hmm. But because of the way that it was worded and because of the kind of broad language that was used throughout the legislation, that it would automatically therefore target other fans and bring them within its remit, and they would feel the effects of it. And that's exactly what proved to happen. And it meant that we were able to build a sort of solidarity around the fact that we were all being negatively affected by it.
Yeah, like you've alluded to, the two phases. So you were set up early doors in 2011 to oppose the legislation, and then it went through. So the campaign, I guess, is split into two, one fairly significantly longer phase.
I mean, I think I've said this before on a couple of other podcasts. I think at the start we were quite naive in the sense that, you know, we kind of thought that we were right and we had the argument. So we had two very clear arguments. One argument was that you can't pick one specific sector of society and apply a law that only applies to them. Law should be universal. You can't discriminate against one group in society. And you also can't criminalise something as subjective as offensiveness, because what you find offensive, I might not, and vice versa. Yeah. And we, and I felt that was quite a strong argument. And we felt that because we knew the legislation would have to go through the parliamentary process, so it would have to go through the Justice Committee, it would have to go through readings and debates, and there would be submissions put forward, etc. We felt that because of the strength of our argument, there was a good chance that, I didn't think the SNP were ever going to bin the bill, but I thought what they might do is take out the most ludicrous aspects of it, and it would sort of soften it by the time it came to vote. But because they had won a majority government in that election and a parliament that was sort of designed to prevent majorities, there was no checks, there was no balance, they had all the hard power, and we could complain on the sidelines all we liked, but they were able to just, you know, like make sure that that went through using their votes, and that's what they've done. And, you know, in hindsight, I don't think there was any other likely scenario there, but at the time we kind of felt that we might prevent it, but we couldn't, unfortunately.
But I guess that's what provided the impetus for you to keep going and then to kind of move on to the next phase, which was to get the repeal. I just wanted to quickly though, you talked there about the SNP and the Scottish Government, and obviously that's kind of who your opposition was over this issue at this point. How did it work? I'm kind of trying to put things in sort of context of where we are at the moment as well. How was your relationship with the club at that point?
No, well, that went up and down. In terms of fact, that went up and down. So it's no secret that Celtic have a better relationship with some of the constituent members of FAC than they do with others. You know, that's not something that will be a surprise to any of them, I don't think. And that's fine, you know, whatever, that's not a complaint. But I think at the start that Celtic were, certainly for the first few years, Celtic were aiding and abetting the police in terms of targeting their own fans. That is something that was absolutely happening. And it meant that a lot of the protests were sort of centred around the club, just as much as they might have been centred around the police or the government. A lot of the times, in terms of dealing with Celtic, they did begin to sort of soften their position. They put out a few statements, but whenever we went to them with, you know, any hard request, anything that would actually have an impact, you know, by the time they get back to you with a response, the issue had usually gone. So there was one particular court case, it went to the High Court, that was one of the kind of defining cases of the Act, I guess. It really set the terms for other arrests. And we'd went to Celtic and begged them for just a letter on, you know, one particular issue. And they hummed and hawed for so long that the court case passed. The boys were found guilty. And it unfortunately meant that a lot of other people were found guilty that didn't need to be if Celtic had got their act together a bit quicker than they did. So there was more of a tension at the start, but I think by the time we got to the point of potentially having the ability to lodge a bill that would actually get it repealed, Celtic had changed their tune. But I think Celtic changed their tune because public opinion was so, you know, massively against the Act, particularly within the Celtic support. Because after a few years, you know, people could remember the incidents on the Gallagher. Everyone had seen videos of the police wading into crowds or, you know, like being really heavy-handed with supporters. So the public opinion against the Act was so strong that Celtic had no choice, really.
How do you think at the time that public opinion was kind of being communicated, or the fan opinion was being communicated, first of all, to the club and also to government and other agencies that were involved?
For me, there are several things that I could point to, but I think the most pertinent and the most poignant was the response to what happened on the Gallagher. So if you remember, in 2013 it would have been, there was a march organised by Celtic fans. Only a couple hundred showed up, you know, walking from the Gallagher up to Celtic Park as a show of solidarity with some of the boys that had been banned as a result of the legislation. And then the police response to it was just absolutely incredible. You know, it was hundreds of officers, you know, riot vans, helicopters, horses, people being kettled, people being hit by batons, children being assaulted by the police, people being arrested. And I think that the you know, the good thing was, obviously, with social media, that was all captured and was all kind of viral very quickly. And I think that for a lot of people, you know, there was, to a certain extent, there was potentially an attitude within some of, if you're not doing anything wrong, the police will not bother you. You know, I think that was something that was maybe just a lingering attitude among some in the support until they'd seen some of this footage. When they'd seen young boys being attacked by the police, when they'd seen footage of, you know, people being, you know, brutalised by Police Scotland. And I think that's what really began to change people's minds. And then either 1 week or 2 weeks later, I can't remember, we played another home game and there was a demonstration organised at George Square. They gathered in George Square, thousands there, and then walked up the same route up to Celtic Park. And I think that was a real show of force from the whole Celtic support. And I think that it was a sort of visual demonstration of the turning of the tide.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things with looking at the moment is obviously the fact that we can't gather in person and these types of kind of demonstrations aren't allowed to happen. They're not safe to happen, you know, different kind of situations as well. The situation is very quick moving. I wonder whether you have any ideas about, were there any things that were happening at that time that didn't involve people physically being present at Celtic Park or those types of demonstrations? Obviously it was key for people to see some of those images to mobilise.
Yeah, I mean, it was, I mean, I wouldn't want to kind of run the campaign that we did under these circumstances, because it would obviously be very difficult. But one thing that we did try to do was use things like social media, things like podcasts to get our message out. We also had quite a good relationship with like different papers, the Herald, websites like Common Space, and other like football fan websites that allowed us not just to get our message out, but a message out to different demographics, you know. So the people that are reading the Herald might not be the same people that are reading you know, some of the kind of football-y websites that we would use, and you would maybe alter your language a wee bit, you would alter the message a little bit. And I guess, you know, there's maybe something similar there for the kind of state of the Celtic support at the minute. You know, the Cynic obviously taps into a certain demographic of football fan, Celtic fan. But there are other ways as well of kind of trying to contact people and sell them on the notion of, something like fan ownership, for example, which I know Jeanette was on doing a few days ago.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we had a great chat with her. Go back and listen to that if anyone's listening to this and hasn't heard it already. Obviously, the big achievement you had was getting this legislation to repeal the act that had gone through in 2012. That was 2018. So the campaign lasted, what, that 6 years before you kind of achieved that ultimate goal?
You know, that was the first piece of legislation in history that has been repealed by the Scottish Parliament, that had been enacted by the Scottish Parliament. And bearing in mind as well, you know, we had started really, you know, a kind of group of normal football fans, a kind of group of BAMs taking on the might of the Scottish government, you know, a majority government. At that point, you know, there wasn't long before it was a newly nationalised police force. And, you know, there were definitely points in the campaign whereby the mountain seemed far too high to ever expect to be able to climb it. But the truth is that football fans had nowhere to go. We weren't going to stop supporting their team. You weren't going to stop going to Celtic games. And if that meant, you know, you were still going to be harassed by the police, you were still going to see friends, people you know being arrested, being kicked through a criminal justice system, then you were still going to put up a fight. And, you know, we obviously managed to, along with the help of people like James Kelly, put together a bill that got it repealed. And that was, you know, I don't think anyone would disagree that was the kind of crowning achievement.
I think a lot of people might see something like that and think, how do you get from being angry about something to having legislation passed in Parliament? Do you know what I mean? So what the steps are to get that done? And from what you've said, I'm kind of taking away that the first thing to do is to get together. And that's one of the things that Jeanette was talking to us about last week as well.
There has to be a body, there has to be some sort of function that allows people to coalesce, you know. So, you know, if it's fan ownership, then the vehicle might be the Celtic Trust. But, you know, when we're talking about, you know, tackling a piece of legislation, it was felt that there would be more credibility to an organisation that brought in the different aspects of the Celtic support. I think the most important thing for us was we agreed on a sort of message quite early on, and we didn't really waver from it. Okay. You know, as I say, the kind of lines I gave earlier about, you know, like laws have to be universal and you can't criminalise something as subjective as offensiveness. You could go back and listen to podcasts from me in 2011 saying they'd word for word the same thing. You know, we agreed on a message quite early. And then, you know, you need to make sure that you build popular support, I think, within your base. So I think at the start, we focused a lot on really trying to get the Celtic support involved. So we would speak about issues that were very specific to the Celtic support, you know, like the ways in which, you know, Irish songs or songs of a political nature were targeted. Whereas when we then go to expand it, you know, your message in terms of how you sell it to different fans changes just ever so slightly, because your argument has to be that as much as they might have intended to target us, they're going to bring you into it, or have started to bring you into it, with arrest for silly things because of the wording of this legislation.
Yeah, I mean, you say that, you're saying that as if it's, and it is, I guess, essentially quite a straightforward thing to do, to sort of adapt your message. But in practice, I imagine there were some big challenges to doing that, and to, you know, whoever was presenting the message, how it was being presented. You know, you talked about different forms of media. That's not an easy task, is it? And I'm sure you didn't find it so.
No, not at all. But it's not something that, you know, I'm sitting here taking credit for, or Jeanette, who was the other sort of face of the campaign, would take credit for either. For me, one of the biggest things about the Celtic support is the wealth of talent that we have within our support. Now, I always felt that one of the kind of political calculations that the SNP made at the time was they thought there was votes to be had and coming down hard on football fans, and that we wouldn't be able to fight back. That was their calculation, that we wouldn't be capable of stopping them. And they continually tarred us as BAMs, as bigots, as drunks, as louts, as this, as that. Yet when it actually came to the campaign, see, whenever we came up with some idea and we needed help, so if we needed sound producers for a podcast, if we needed video editors for a video, people to paint banners, you know, lawyers to help with legal advice, Absolutely anything that we came up with, there was someone on hand from the Celtic support willing to offer their services. And that's why it was a collective achievement. It wasn't just an achievement of, you know, a few individuals or even FAC as an organisation. The amount of people that came to FAC who weren't necessarily directly involved, offering their services, offering their skills. And that's what helped get over the line.
Yeah, and I think that's probably quite encouraging for people to hear as well, that if it doesn't necessarily mean if you want to affect change, you have to go in two-footed and be the face of the campaign or get complete, let it take over your life. It could be that you help with painting banners or you give professional advice that you're able to give or what you're saying, exactly what you're saying.
When we needed, you know, like a unique skill set, you know, no matter what it was, sometimes it was, you know, it was something way out there. There was always someone willing to do it. You know, if it was a computer coder, for example, for the email campaign that we ran, we got someone, no problem. But see, if we needed, rather than, you know, a kind of specific skill set, a kind of qualitative thing, if you needed someone, if you needed numbers, if it was all about quantity, what you had right away was fans on the street. If we called a demo, there would be thousands there. If we were doing an email campaign, thousands took part. If we were trying to raise money, for example, the Amsterdam Boys, you know, we raised, you know, tens of thousands of pounds. And it was because the Celtic support was unified. So, you know, it was a case of, you know, no matter how kind of big or small, everyone has a part to play. And without that support that fueled us throughout the years, there's absolutely no way we would have got the result that we did.
Yeah, amazing. The thing that I've been thinking about as well is, we talked about the fact that legislation was repealed in 2018. Is FAC still going as a kind of campaigning organisation, and do you have current objectives?
So in terms of when the Act was repealed, the kind of first season after that, we did kind of maintain a kind of similar structure. And I felt that there were still problems with policing of football fans, particularly because the culture of policing, you know, if police officers have been trained to view fans as a sort of criminal threat for the best part of 6-7 years, changing the law isn't going to change the mindsets. So a lot of those problems still remained. So we did raise, you know, we particularly there was the issue with a near crushing incident at Celtic Park versus Rangers when the police, you know, really exacerbated the situation, you know, when people were going, asking for help, asking for them to, you know, prevent crowds moving in and try to make sure that no one was seriously hurt. The standard reaction of the police that day was to threaten people with arrest, you know, if they didn't stop talking to them. So we still had to deal with things like that. And I think that what we were trying to push was a review of policing of fans in Scotland more generally, an independent review. But then obviously, to be fair, I would have said that last season things were quite a bit better than the season before. And then obviously, you know, towards the end of last season, the workload. But what I would say is that we're still dealing with some cases that were previously Offensive Behaviour Act cases. Yeah. So they were, you know, dropped as per the repeal. But then they were changed to, you know, like a breach of the peace or whatever it may be. And now because of COVID, you know, keep getting delayed and put back because the courts are a bit of a shambles at the moment. Yeah. So we're still dealing with things like that. But we don't meet, even virtually, you know, we don't meet every few months. But myself and Jeanette will maybe just stay in touch and making sure that if anything arises, we're going to have to deal with it. But it doesn't have the same focus or need for the same focus, I guess, at this point.
I was also going to ask you, and I know that this might not be a very fair question, but you said earlier you wouldn't want to be running the campaign that you ran to repeal the Offensive Behaviour at Football Act now because of the circumstances. But what, from what you've learned from running that campaign, do you think could be done? Your relationship, especially with the club and of kind of organising a disparate group of people, is there kind of positives that you could take away from that, that you think in terms of wanting change, whether it is, like you said, fan ownership, whether it's as simple as changing the manager, how would you approach it?
For me, it's still something that can be achieved in terms of, you can still run a successful campaign in these times. It's an extra hurdle to overcome. What I would say is that I mean, we, you know, try to make the best of, I mean, social media is really what you've got, isn't it? If you can't be in person, if you can't be at games, you can't be singing, you can't be, you know, showing Sack the Board banners for the Tegesies, then really what you've got left is trying to be creative online. You know, if and when it's safe, there can maybe be protests in person or whatever. But really, the Celtic support has got to try, for me, in terms of if we're discussing fan ownership, to get involved with the trust is certainly important. I would urge anybody listening to join the trust, and I say that as a fellow member as well. But there's lots of way that, because what you're trying to do in a campaign is you're trying to win hearts and minds. So, you know, it used to be that, you know, the best way to do that would be in person, but now we have this whole other world that's available to us through our laptops, through our phones. And you can see the world over that is changing minds for good or for bad, I guess, in some cases. But in terms of things like, you know, we've done things like podcasts, we've done email campaigns, we created videos of, you know, the campaign as a whole, but videos on specific issues. You know, there's plenty of ways that you can influence how other people view a certain topic or issue. It just so happens that at the moment, you're kind of robbed, I guess, of, you know, the most traditional kind of political outlets of demos or public meetings, you know, would be another. But I mean, the Trust held a public meeting on Zoom maybe a month or so ago, I can't remember. Jeanette got me into trouble for not remembering when that was. But, like, you know, so as hard as it is, you know, that these options are still there. And, you know, given the kind of circumstances that our club now finds itself in, you know, I think that the support has to do everything that we can to try to harness that, you know, anger that's out there, because we've had the piss ripped at us as fans all season. Quite a few of us had seen some of these problems coming before they eventually surfaced. And I think the important thing is, you know, like in terms of like the season, the 10, it's gone. It kills you to admit it, but the season's gone. And there's not going to be a campaign or the trust or any sort of clever slogan or anything that we can do that's going to change that.
Yeah.
It's done. But what you can do is try to create enough of a base in the support, get enough people involved with the trust that hopefully we can start to develop enough hard power that this doesn't happen again. And that if, you know, there are issues a few years down the line, whatever way they might manifest, whatever shape they might take, the biggest problem this season has been, as much as the footballing department's an absolute shambles, it's how unwilling that board has been to listen to the fans. How unwilling they've been, you know, even when the truth has been clear as day, when it's been right in front of their face, they've dug in rather than admitting that the fans have been right on this all along. So the only way that you can hope to prevent another catastrophic season like this unfolding again is by making sure that the next time that they've got no choice but to listen to this.
Yeah, I think that's it, isn't it? I think it's that unwillingness by the board to listen that's felt so frustrating, because it feels like it doesn't matter how angry the fan base get, or no matter what their opinion is at this point, it's not going to be listened to. So to use a phrase that has been used slightly differently earlier in the season, it is about culture change. But like in the sense of, like you said, slightly longer term, make sure it doesn't happen in the future. And if we can,
I mean,
if, as you say, you know, I think more people have now come around to the idea that the 10 is gone, it then becomes about the rebuilding, doesn't it? And the shifting of what the club looks like and what we can do to influence that.
Yeah, for me, like, if we are to take it, I mean, obviously, the last kind of calendar year has been really hard for everybody, you know, football aside. The football has been absolutely chronic since it returned, you know, it's not been easy for us. But if we are to take anything for this, anything at all, it has to be that we hopefully have a bigger say in the way our clubs run going forward. That has to be the end goal. Otherwise, you know, we'll have taken nothing at all for this year.
Yeah, I think it's many people listening to this will agree with that. And It's just about how we get there. And I think it's really great to hear your story and the story of your colleagues and all of those people you work with, and the fact that, you know, you talk about strength in numbers and that kind of everyone has got their part to play in it. And it's just about kind of finding out what you can contribute if you do want to sort of shift things along a little bit. I mean, at the moment, it just feels like we're in this sort of limbo land every day waiting for news and it doesn't come. But I think we'll all appreciate hearing that. I'm sure there'll be questions and things that will arise from people from hearing what you've had to say. But is there anything else that you want to add before we tie up?
No, not that I can immediately think of. But yeah, I think that your point is kind of right in terms of this is the stage that the support has to act. Mm. You know, we can't look back in 20 years and still have as little say in the way our club is run as that we do now. Yeah. And, you know, it might take a long time. Nobody's expecting for, you know, the trust or for the support generally to have a majority stake in a club anytime soon. But what you can do is just bit by bit start to build on that. And that's what we have to do now, because I don't want to look back in 10, 20 years and see that nothing's changed, to see that we're still beholden to some absentee landlord billionaire who doesn't give a fuck about us.
Yeah.
That's just where we are. So we need to make sure that we act to change that now.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said, little by little, step by step, change can happen. And that's how it happened for you guys. Thank you so much, Paul, for coming and chatting to us. I'm sure there's lots more that we could talk about and probably or possibly will do at some point in the future, especially if people come back to us with questions. But I really appreciate you taking the time with us.
Yeah, no problem at all. Thanks very much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Well, there we have it, troops. That was Claire Wilde talking to Paul Quigley of FAC. Hope that was some food for thought and gives you some ideas about how we can make change as Celtic supporters over the next while. In the next episode in the series, Claire will be talking to me, Erin Slaven, about the On The Ball campaign, which campaigned for free period products at football grounds and started at Celtic Park. So make sure to tune in for the next one. We'll see you down the road.